good afternoon now. I had not forgotten the question that Catherine asked about avidité, greed, and I will address it in one form or another. In Zen tradition, as opposed to some other Buddhist schools, and even Zen, you know, some of you have heard me say that Zen is really on the fringe of Buddhism. I tend not to call myself Buddhist, but a Zen practitioner. But one of the particularities of the Zen tradition is it's what's called a transmission outside of the texts, the sutras, the scriptures, anything written, anything formal. Really the hallmark of Zen practice is that it's outside of all of that. The point, what this practice is about, is outside of all of that. And therefore, there's a lot of, there can be confusion because it seems to be so ritualized, and we chant these sutras, and we don't actually chant much, but compared to some different schools and traditions. And we talk about this person who we call the Buddha. And yet, that's not what it's about. So, that's a paradox. But Zen is a paradox. So that's basically what it's about, too, is the paradox of being and not being. Although, it's not that it's not being, and it's not that it's not being. So, it's confusing. Essentially, the point is it's about experience rather than intellect. And therefore, in our tradition, we use a lot of storytelling. We refer to stories of experiences that happened, that are, you can verify them historically. We use them as examples of what we are looking to experience. And we say often, don't seek to walk in the footsteps of these people who came before. Seek what they sought. So we're using these examples as inspiration or instruction for how you can go about your practice and what is to be looked for, sought. Even this, you know, we put this statue on the altar. It's not about venerating that statue or even venerating that what that statue represents, that person. It's about using that as a reminder of what he realized and pointed to for us to realize as well about who we are, what is the nature of all phenomenon, what is the nature of being. So we use that as a reminder. And sometimes we can push this to a really far extent where we say it doesn't even matter if that's a representation of a specific person in a specific posture. I use this example of having practiced in the streets of New York and in an abandoned schoolyard, the altar, like that, was a tree stump with a beer can on it. And that was sacred. Everything is sacred in this context. That beer can was represented what we call the Buddha. We can discuss this at length. You can ask questions about it. I'm just giving you this as an example of not to lose sight of what the point is. It's not about all of the, although I told you about the ritual. But it's not the ritual in and of itself, the whatever it is, you know. It's not about the three bells that ring to begin the sitting. What is that pointing us towards, is what the point is. So, this morning I'd like to talk about a story that we use in our tradition. That's one of my, many of you have heard this story before, but it's one that is very evocative and comes from a collection of these stories that we use in our practice, which is called the Mumen Kan, this collection, or the Gateless Gate, or the Gateless Barrier, I guess this translation presents it, calls it. In this story, there's a person who reappears throughout these, in other of these stories, because he goes on to become a Zen master. But in this story, he is not yet. His name is Tokusan, and he lived in China in the 8th, 9th century, which was the golden age of Zen, they say, when a lot of great teachers lived, and it really took hold in China, and a lot of the teachings we still use today come from that period. So his name is Tokusan, and he lived in the north of China, and China at that time had different emperors ruling, and there was the north and the south. I won't go into a lot of details, it doesn't matter. In the south, Buddhism had been practiced in China for a few centuries at this point. But in the south, a teacher had come from India, and I think in the 6th century. And he had brought what we consider him to be the first Zen ancestor for us, because he brought from India what he said was this special transmission outside the sutras. It didn't involve memorizing sutras, studying them, being erudite, being an expert on this or this arcane point about Buddhist discourse. It involved experiencing this, just as it is right now. This guy in the north, Tokusan, and so this practice of experiential Zen was starting to take hold in the south, but it hadn't reached the north. But he, this guy Tokusan, was a young man, and he was an expert in one of the sutras, the Diamond Sutra. And he knew everything about it, and went around, traveled around northern China, lecturing about it, debating with people about the finer points of it and whatever. And he was renowned for this, and he was quite famous in northern China for this. And he heard that in the south, there was this other practice taking hold. And he thought these were heretics. And he decided that he would go south, and he was going to teach them and tell them where they were wrong, that they needed to know, that they needed to stay with the sutras, learn them, study them, know them profoundly. And he was going to be the one who did it. So he made this long journey to the south, down the Yangtze River, and carrying on his back all of his notes and commentaries and scrolls that he had about the Diamond Sutra, in a big box on his back. One day, he stops by the side of the road, and there is an old woman in a tea house by the side of the road selling snacks, tea, food. So he decides to stop for some refreshment. And she says to him, "Oh, venerable monk." He was a monk. And it was very clear from the way he was dressed and whatever. And she said, "Oh, venerable monk, what are you carrying on your back?" And he said, "Oh, it's the the commentary in my notes about the Diamond Sutra, because I am well-schooled and an expert on the Diamond Sutra. And she said, oh, okay, can I ask you a question? And he said, yes, ask me any question you want about the Diamond Sutra. And she said, if you can answer the question, I will offer you the cakes and tea, all you want. And he said, okay, go ahead. So she said, in the Diamond Sutra, it says, and she quoted from the Diamond Sutra, the mind of the past is ungraspable. The mind of the present is ungraspable. The mind of the future is ungraspable. I'm translating it as ungraspable. Sometimes it's translated as unattainable. But it's, I think it might speak to us more ungraspable. So she quoted that, and she said, if that's the case, as the Diamond Sutra says, with which mind will you take these cakes and tea? And Toku-san is stumped. Desperate. He doesn't know what to say. Very shaken. And so he says to her, is there a Zen master in this neighborhood? And she said, yes, actually there is. Up the road or up the mountain, I think it was more like up the mountain, there is Master Ryotan, who's a very good Zen master. There's been a lot of speculation. I'm doing a little parenthetical take here. That there have been recent studies in the past, say, 20 years, looking into women in the Buddhist tradition, because most of the stories, there are no women. And occasionally there's an old lady like this. They're always old ladies. There's one beautiful young woman who becomes famous because she disfigures herself so that she can be peaceful in a monastery, because otherwise the men bug her all the time. Otherwise, they're all these old ladies. And none of them have very prominent roles. And so a lot of historians started doing research and have discovered that, in fact, there were many women Zen masters. And women practiced as much as the men. And although their names were never, as we even say in some of our chanting sometimes, their names were either forgotten, overlooked, or just left unsaid. We just didn't mention them. So there is some speculation that this old lady in this story may well have been herself a Zen master. Even if she wasn't, she had obviously was aware of what the Zen practice was, knew the Zen master, and could see through Toku-san and see where he was stuck, and to see that he was quite ignorant about some aspects. So she was actually probably a wise old lady. She wasn't just some old lady selling tea by the side of the road. So he goes off, Toku-san, and goes to this monastery and finds this master, and is determined to consider this question that this old woman had asked him, but also to talk with this Zen master and show him how much he knew. Toku-san wanted to prove to the Zen master that he was an expert on the Diamond Sutra. And so it's not clear the chronology how long Toku-san was actually there, but at some point he and the Ryotan, the master, were talking deep into the night, going over probably all kinds of fine points of the Diamond Sutra, and having tea and discussing whatever. And at Finally, the master said, "It's getting very late, you should probably go." Tokusan agreed, and he picked up all of his things and put his box of things back on his back and started going. And when he went to open the door to the hut of the Zen master, it was pitch dark outside. And he said, "It's pitch dark." And the master said, "Oh, yes, of course." And he turned and lit him a candle and gave him the candle. And just as Tokusan was taking the candle and about to go outside with it, the master blew out the candle. At this moment, Tokusan suddenly, as we say in these stories, had a moment of great enlightenment. The candle was out, everything was pitch black, and in that moment, he saw. And he turned around to the, thanked the master profusely and whatever, and master, just checking on him, said, "Well, what is your realization?" And he said something to the effect of, "I now see what is the truth, and I will no longer doubt the teachings of the past," or something. I don't know. It doesn't really matter so much what he said. The next day, the master told this story in front of all of the assembly, the assembled monks. He didn't tell the story. He just said, there is a monk in our presence who has had a deep realization, and he will go on to have a future great teacher. He'd become a great teacher himself, something like that. I could read the real quote, but it's kind of this flowery thing about how he has fangs and blood in his mouth and things, which doesn't really matter. Just means that he's the real deal, and he foresees a great future for him. And so then Tokusan comes before all of them and says something equally flowery, but and then very ceremoniously burns all of his notes, commentary, scrolls of the Diamond Sutra. Tokusan will then go on to become, as I said, a great teacher, and we have various stories like this of him through in different periods of his life. This story is from when before he became a teacher. The next story is one where he, it's a famous story that we also use in our practice, where he says, it's called Tokusan's 30 Blows. And he says to his student, "If you say yes, I will give you 30 blows. If you say no, I will give you 30 blows. What do you say?" So, as a Zen student, you have to sit with this and experience this question for yourself. That story comes when Tokusan was a young green teacher. And then in, later in life, there's another story about him. I won't go into that because it's more elaborate, but where he's very soft and non-confrontational. So we can see there's an evolution, which gives us all hope, right? We evolve. Like we said last night when we were talking with Christine and Catherine about our childbirth experiences. We evolved. We changed. We all change, and we've changed since I began speaking. We changed since this morning. We've changed since I started that sentence. And everything's changing at every moment. Now, if we stick to sutras and knowledge, intellectual knowledge, and being an expert, we are not acknowledging and being in phase with that change. We are stuck somewhere. So Tokusan was very much attached to his expertise. And as we say, in the expert's mind, very little is possible. In the beginner's mind, the possibilities are unlimited. And we know that ourselves. You know, you come here for a retreat for the first time, you have no idea what to expect. Everything is new. You're discovering everything. For those of us who have been in retreats before, it's not new. We have to really sit down and let go in order for things to be new again, in order to see them in a new way. So what happens with Tokusan when the candle is blown out? It's kind of, we could say maybe, to stick with what I just said, that's the equivalent of becoming a beginner again. So everything you know, everything you think you know, everything you want to know, all the positions you have and everything are, the light goes out and you can't see anything anymore. Or the rug is pulled out from under you. And suddenly in that moment he sees. What does he see? So, he sees things as they are, we say. He sees it. And it, I can't even say he sees it, that's not even, because it's black, right? So we can say he's not even really seeing. He's experiencing it. And this is what we are aiming for. We are aiming to experience that mysterious thing that Tokusan experienced. It doesn't make any sense to you. You're kind of like, well, what did he experience? And I can sit here and I can tell you all afternoon different possibilities of what he experienced, but that's not at all important, because what's important is for you to experience it, what he experienced. No, it's like, okay, I drank this water and I experienced that. I feel that. Wonderful. You didn't experience it. You watched me do it. And I can tell you about it. I can tell you what it felt like going down my throat, in my mouth, if it's cold or not. I can tell you about how it feels to hold the glass. But that's not the same thing as you having that experience. So the sutras, they tell us about drinking the water, but that's not the same thing as drinking the water. They can help point us in the right direction, but just because we're pointed in the right direction doesn't mean we will go in the right direction. And I'm not saying this right and wrong, because in a sense, there are no wrong directions. There's just your direction. However, there can be confusion, there can be, as we say, greed, anger, ignorance. I think we chant that this morning, no? Didn't we? Mm. In the Oryoki we chant that, yeah?
No,
no.
In the morning, that's right, that's right. No, we just chanted it this morning, yeah. That's right. Because those are what are called the three poisons. In any Buddhist tradition you encounter, you will find those three poisons. Those are the basic aspects of all the problems in our life are born from those three basic problems. So what is the root of those three poisons, as we say? And I might add that as with any poison, there is an antidote to each of those. So the antidote to greed is generosity. The antidote to anger is compassion. And the antidote to ignorance is wisdom. Sounds good, right? Sounds obvious. Huh. Well, that's the program, because we can't just apply generosity and automatically greed goes away. Or just apply wisdom and ignorance goes away. We have to look into the root cause of each of those. So we'll just stick with greed, because that's what Catherine asked about this morning. In this case of Tokusan, we see the root of his troubles, are his belief in his attachment to him and what he thinks and what he knows. And he is smarter than these heretics in the South. He has accumulated much more knowledge than anyone else about the Diamond Sutra. And he's holding very tightly to this identity. He's carrying around on his back, in fact, in a box, right? And he's, at every moment, looking to be able to demonstrate this. So as soon as the old lady asks him, he's very, putting this very forward, this identity, this persona that he has. And this is an example of the root cause of all of the problems. Because, as I said, we're changing all the time. And we don't have a fixed I, as we think we do. It doesn't mean that there is not me and my name and my story and my family. That doesn't mean that. But I'm not who I think I am, is what it means. I'm actually a fluid part of a whole that includes everything. I am just one manifestation of this fluid whole. And I repeat fluid because it's always changing. Scientifically, you can prove it. You know, you can... I'm sure the biologist can tell us about cellular biology, and that cells are dying and being recreated. And if you take apart this body, you break it down, it's nothing. You know, it's water, essentially. And water, as we know, evaporates and then comes back. And it's not fixed. If you freeze water, you make ice cubes. Well, then, it's a different form. It takes a different manifestation of water, but it's still the same whole, as we say. And so the birds, the trees, the flowers, the book, each one of us, different manifestations of this whole. When we lose sight of that, when we think we are separate, then everything... Our life, everything becomes revolved around trying to maintain that sense of separateness and differentiation. We focus on the differences rather than the similarities, what we share, rather than focusing on what we share, we focus on what we think is mine. And this is where greed comes from. Because ultimately, our nature is groundless. But we experience, when we don't experience that groundlessness of our being, that fluidity of our being, we experience it as lack. And therefore, we want to fill it up. We want to obtain. We want to hold so that we don't feel that emptiness. We don't feel that lack. What we feel is missing. But it's like trying to fill up a bottomless pit. Or fill up a well with snow, you know, the snow will melt. There is no bottom, and so we keep throwing stuff into this pit, but it's bottomless. It can't be filled. We're trying to fill what can't be filled. So Tokusan is trying to fill it with his stuff he's carrying on his back and his identity of Mr. Know-it-all about the Diamond Sutra. And in that moment, when first of all, his confidence is shaken by the old woman's question. Because basically what that phrase from the Diamond Sutra is saying, that everything is ungraspable. There's nothing to hold on to. And so if Tokusan is an expert on this text that says everything is ungraspable or unattainable, and she's asking him a very concrete, simple question, well, so then what do you take these cakes and tea with? if everything is ungraspable? He can't answer. And that's the first crack in his position. You have a question?
Yeah. That's not exactly the question she asked, is it? She asked, with what mind?
With what mind, yeah. That's right.
That's not a simple question.
No, but if you think of this guy who's an expert and has studied Diamond Sutra, has gone into, you know, probably great elaborations about what the mind is and what grasping is and what unattaining, probably, I'm assuming, you know.
I'm having a hard time with this because for me the answer is an ungraspable mind.
So, you mean, so he would say an ungraspable mind, okay. So, fair enough. At the same time, that is an explanation, or it's conceptual. It's not an experiential response. So what would be the experiential response to that ungraspable mind? How would experientially you demonstrate that, the ungraspable mind, with which he will take the cakes or drink the tea?
It's an experience. It's not an experiential question. To me, I mean, the question is conceptual, so the answer has to be conceptual.
Well, see, that would be the conceptual way of thinking about it, because her question is not conceptual. Actually, she's asking him a direct question, and this is where our difficulty comes, because we can grasp it. I'm using this word intentionally. We can grasp it with our mind. Say, okay, oh yeah, I see, okay. So it must be with the ungraspable mind. But then the question remains, which mind is that? If the past, present, and future minds are ungraspable, which mind is not grasped? Is, you know, so how do you do it then? What do you do? And
but I don't eat with my mind. I eat with my hands and my mouth.
Okay, so then what is mind? And we're assuming, like I said to Guillaume, that in this text it's been discussed what mind is. And so then what? If you eat with your hands and your mouth.
I don't eat with my mind.
So then you're making a difference between mind and everything else. Which, you know, my point today is not really to go into what is mind, but mind is everything, in a sense. This would be for another discussion, but and this text, the Diamond Sutra, would have said that, or would have gone into, because sometimes the question, there are questions in these stories, what is mind? And it could be the bird crying outside, the answer. What is mind? What is mind? The Buddha. What is mind? No mind, no Buddha. I mean, it's infinite, the responses that are given in these stories. But that is the heart of it. So this is an interesting place to look for you, is, okay, well, what is mind? I don't eat with my mind, I eat with my hands and mouth. So, okay, well, then what's this old lady saying? You know? And what is Toku-san not seeing? Because if he's an expert, he must know that. But that's not it. So what is it then? This is where these stories encourage us to look closer, 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 deeper, deeper, deeper.
Another question.
Please.
Groundless. So what is groundless? Everything is groundless?
Mm-hmm.
In the infinite, I can accept that.
Mm.
But in the day-to-day, there's life and there's death.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. And this, again, this brings us to the paradox, again, of, okay, in the absolute, there are no differences. You know, in the absolute, everything is one. No life, no death, no old, no young, no man, no woman, in the absolute, right? As you say, I can accept that in the infinite. I'm choosing the word absolute rather than infinite. But at the same time, there is man, there is woman. There is small, tall. There is relative. So we say there are these two aspects of life, relative and absolute. Most of the time we spend our lives focusing on the relative and making distinctions, like I said. We focus on the differences rather than on the sameness. If we go into the complete opposite, if we stay in this dualistic thinking and we focus only on the absolute, no differences, it would take the form of totalitarianism, where everyone is supposed to be the same. We can push it even to the point where it goes to, it brings us to Auschwitz, because anything that is not like us, we destroy. You know, we want everything to be the same. It opens the door to the Pandora's box of all abuses, because we don't make distinctions about what is appropriate for a child and what's appropriate for an adult. You know, as parents, we know there are things we don't tell our children. There are things that aren't appropriate for children. We have to make those distinctions. But if we focus only on the absolute, we won't make those decisions. And then anything goes, right? That, too, is not appropriate. So how do we hold them both? How do we experience the oneness, the absolute, and the differences? So the relative and the absolute. That's the question. And again, it comes back to this experience. In the moment, when we are no longer attached to differences or oneness, we see that the two are not two, the one. We are the manifestation of the absolute and the relative, right here now. We die, we're born, we die, and yet there is something that, it's hard to say it without sounding dualistic, but something doesn't die. Something is unborn. And that's what we're looking to experience, because we're very familiar with what dies and what doesn't, or we think we are. We have a lot of concepts around birth and death as well. But until we can see the absolute, until we experience the absolute aspect of our being, we tend to be stuck in the relative. And then we have all these problems, because we think of ourselves as this relative, only this relative being who has this story and is this age and has this family and this job and all of this stuff. We think of ourselves only as that. And then we're very limited. There's infinite stories about it, but... So, does that give you some elements to look into?
Yeah. Reminds me of my nanny when my baby was 3 months old and hit her head and she was crying and crying. I was thinking she's always crying. And my nanny said, "C'est pas grave, elle va changer."
That's true. She did, right? Yeah. It's true. So Toku-san, and greed, and self-clinging, these are all like themes that reappear all the time in our lives, in our practice. we can be attached to, we're not only attached to a positive image of ourselves, we can be attached to a negative image of ourselves and put ourselves down and not see who we truly are, and look for affirmation outside of ourselves all the time. Anything that will make us feel grounded, where in fact the true grounding has to come from here. Because I say the nature of all things is groundless. At the same time, it's possible to, as we say, dwell in this non-dwelling. So to be grounded in the groundlessness. The only way to be grounded in the groundlessness is to experience the groundlessness truly for what it is, not as lack or what's missing.
Can you experience that in very short moments and forget?
Yes.
And
yes. And sometimes, so there are different possibilities too, because sometimes we experience it and then it was such a fabulous thing, we loved it so much, we felt so good that we want to hang on to it. And of course it can't be hung on to. By very nature, it's groundless and can't be grasped. And as soon as we try to hang on to it, it's gone. We make it into something, you know, we make it into something we'll carry around on our back. Or another possibility, I'm not sure if this is what you mean, but we might experience that and then it's gone and we forget about it and don't think about it anymore. I know for myself, but I know from other people too, and just have observing, spending a lot of time with my own children and other children. I think children at a quite young age experience this kind of as the basic experience of life. And they're very free and open and are capable of role-playing very easily and like to role-play and are in tune with nature in a way that we lose as adults. They relate to animals in a different way than adults generally do. These are manifestations of what has not been fixed yet to the extent that we have fixed ourselves. Now, of course, a certain element of fixation is necessary. Everything I'm telling you, I would not recommend to someone who is psychotic. Someone who doesn't have a strong sense of self cannot let go of this fixed identity or positioning or something like that. You need to be grounded somewhat in order to acknowledge the groundlessness. But someone who's psychotic, they don't have any sense of groundlessness, of groundedness. So I think children then forget it, because they might talk about these things with adults, but the way that it's received by the adult is kind of like, oh yes, it's nothing, forget it, or that's not really how things are, or this is how you're supposed to be, or things like that. So children forget it, and it's gone, and they don't. I know in my own case, when I started doing this practice, things came back to me, recollections of when I was a child, and I realized, oh yeah, that's what was happening. And I didn't pay any attention to it. It was fleeting, and there was no one to tell it to, and no one was paying any attention to it, so I just let go of it, forgot about it. Another possibility is that, as I said, these experiences are fleeting. It's a glimpse, and it's gone, and we know that it's gone, but we don't forget it in the sense that we can remind ourselves of it. We can say, oh yeah, I had that experience once. And I know that there's something there. I know what that felt like. Because it's once you've had that kind of experience, it's in you, even if you forget it or you spend your time trying to get back to it, which is human. It's there. And if it happens again, you'll recognize it. And when you hear people talk about it, you recognize something in it, even if you're not really so clear. I always say to people, if you've come to a Zen retreat like this, and you're listening to the teacher saying things, there's something in it that resonates for you. You wouldn't do this otherwise. You maybe don't know so much what it is, you maybe are bored with it sometimes, or you don't agree with all of it or something, but there's something in it that resonates, or you wouldn't be here. Trust that. Trust what it is that resonates. And even if you forgot it, well, try to just say, okay, well, I know that it happened once. I know that it did. I maybe don't remember so much what it was, but it did happen once. And trust that it can happen again. It'll be an accident, as we say. By nature, it can't be programmed. It's an accident. It's wild. That's why we're called the Wildflower Sangha, because it's wild. It's actually, everything is chaos. We like to organize it and think that it's we can control it, but it's chaos. Everything is an accident. We say, however, that in this, or I didn't invent this, but the teacher of my teacher's teacher, this Japanese guy who brought Zen to America, used to say, an experience like this is an accident. And all of our practice is just trying to cultivate the ground so that accidents can happen. So we want accidents to happen. Of course, when we want accidents to happen, they don't happen because they're not accidents. So we just sit here. We just sit. And we let things be. And the ordinary mind, the ordinary accidental mind, is present. And we just see what happens. And don't interfere with it. So were you asking that question theoretically, or do you feel like that's your experience as you forgot?
Well, yeah. Then it's a memory, and then it's conceptual.
Yeah.
It loses that
freshness.
Aliveness.
Yeah. So it's tricky because at the same time it's precious that because you recognize you know it somehow. At the same time it's tricky because it becomes this concept, and we want to go back to it, and I know I spent a long time doing that. Fortunately, I had a good teacher who just kept pulling the rug out from under me and wouldn't let me do that. And that's what the teacher is supposed to help you do. And in the story with Tokusan, the commentaries go on to say that, you know, he didn't need to burn the sutras. He didn't need to do that. That true realization, if you will, or maybe later in his life he wouldn't have, is to be one with both. So you can study the sutras and expound the sutras, as we say, talk about them. And at the same time, see that it's a special transmission outside the sutras. That to burn them like he did was showing still an attachment to the sutras, in a sense, because he was so attached to the sutras that he had to burn them. Attached to an identity of what the sutras are or are not, let's say. probably the late Tokusan would not have burned the sutras, but that can't, he wouldn't have been the young Tokusan if he was the late Tokusan. So. It's like when an interviewer asked the Dalai Lama after Bush had ordered the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11, the interviewer, it was Carl Zero, actually. Does anyone know who Carl Zero is? The guy from Canal Plus, asked the Dalai Lama, if you were George W. Bush, what would you have done? And the Dalai Lama just laughed, that really hearty laugh that he laughs, you know? because if he was George W. Bush, he wouldn't be George W. Bush. He wouldn't be the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama would never be in the position that George W. Bush was in. So, you can only be you. That's the good news and the bad news, as we always say. There's nowhere to go but here, and it's only you. So that's all of that's the good news and the bad news. The bad news because, I'm not going to be someone else, and I can't run away. But that's also the good news. You don't have to be anyone else, and you don't need anything else except what's right here now.
Like Amy, the other day at work, I made a mistake, and then after a few days, my senior colleagues came in to me and said, "Why did you do this?" And I didn't know. I couldn't answer. Like I couldn't remember why I had the what I did, and I just come up with an excuse and say, "I don't know. I just thought that this was the correct approach," but I couldn't remember what I thought when I did what I did. And this, does it mean that the mind of the past isn't graspable? Like we cannot really remember or think what we were thinking at the time. This past doesn't exist anymore.
Well, let's see, how can we approach this? There is no past, present, and there's only now, right?
Yeah.
So, there is nothing to grasp in the past or the future because there is no past or future, it's only now. And, of course, we have memories of, and I'm not denying, we have memories of things we experienced in the past. And we have projections of what we would look forward to in the future. But the memories are now. And the projections are just now. There's not anything other than now. So when you say that at this moment, that's what you said. And at the moment when you did it, it was also now. It wasn't past. Does it matter what you said?
I don't know. I think people were just... I don't know if they were asking because they wanted to know next time, don't do this, or... They were just giving me a hard time. Why did you do this? And I didn't know. I couldn't remember. I just said, well, I think that's what I thought was correct.
Mm.
But I didn't really... I couldn't remember what I saw and why did I think that this was the correct thing. Or,
Well, your answer... In the now, even now when you're telling this, it's probably different than it actually happened. There have even been studies about this of, you know, people, memory, And it's unbelievable, but most of us don't actually tell stories about how things actually happened. There's stuff that's forgotten or perspectives that were forgotten, and they've done this, you know, different people together experiencing something and they all tell it differently and whatever. It's already different. It's now. And so, of course, for your colleagues, that's not how they're thinking. So they want to know exactly what happened in the past, because for them, that's there's a past and a future and present, and they want to know exactly. And in our work situations or in the daily life, as we were saying, we have to marry the two, in a sense. How do we deal with both of those? Whatever came for you is probably the best response, because there was no other response. And you said, I just thought that's what was right.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing... nothing to look for in the past, in other words, to try to dig back and remember exactly what. You might, for the purposes of your boss, you know, but...
You can't not. You must. In
if you have an account to hold to, yes. If someone is asking you, then you must, exactly. At the same time, you can see what it is. Can you see that, okay, this is what I'm being held accountable for, something I did last week or yesterday or whatever it was. And within the context of this job I'm doing, I need to do that. At the same time, my self-worth and my being does not depend on that. It's now. So you have to hold these both.
Like the present moment, I notice, okay, this is a mistake, next time I'll do it different. But if you ask me at that moment, in the past, why did I did this, and explain, ask me to explain again, step by step, what I thought, what I was thinking, when I was doing what I was doing, I can't say. So I just said, okay, I got it. Next time I'll do different. But they're like going on and on and on, wanting to know why. I'm like, I don't know. This.
So. Sounds like that was the only response you could give. And we can, at the same time, we can understand, if we think to these people, why your colleagues were not satisfied, is because they're very attached to explanations, definitions, wanting it explained, wanting you to be accountable for what you did in the past and whatever, and just saying, I don't know, I'm sorry, isn't enough for them, for whatever reason.
I could see that,
yeah.
But at the same time, I couldn't give them anything else.
Mm.
So, it's not an easy conversation.
What?
It was not an easy conversation.
No, I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. And you might ask yourself, well, why don't I know what I did?
Yeah.
What is it that kept me from remembering what I did? No, I don't mean in the past.
I think the need for an explanation comes from that wanting to control situations, you know, that if she's able to recapitulate what happened, can you say that to someone what had happened in her mind, that like that she would, we can prevent from happening it again, but if she doesn't, it
right.
might happen again, something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. And also for you know, maybe wanting to control the person too, you know,
yes.
and make the person point out the other's errors and faults. One of our precepts that we take is, I vow to refrain from focusing on others' errors and faults. But in a case like this, maybe that was the motivation, because then if someone else is making a mistake and is wrong, then I feel better about myself. Again, it comes back to this myself, wanting to make myself big and the other small. I don't know if that's their motivation.
I don't know. There's the material and the immaterial. Right? If you're in charge of making a train go and the train crashes, you need to understand
what happened.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing you need to, then there's the immaterial, which is the whole attitude, potentially witch hunt, potentially identity issue. But I mean, in the material world, we need to understand where the knife is, where you put it. You have to remember where you put it.
Absolutely. And so then the question is, okay, how do we go about doing that? You know, so how do we go about making sure that the train runs on time? How do we go about making sure the knife goes in the right place? How do we go about making sure that a mistake in someone's accounts doesn't happen again? Or how do we, you know, take care of someone's accounts, whatever. That how we do it and our experience of doing that is directly related to how we experience the whole of life. We will do it differently. Is it almost lunchtime? It's time. Okay. We will do it differently if we have an experience of of our own true nature. Then if we won't blame others, we will see that the other was trying to do her best too, or if she's not, we would see what's happening for her. We would try to live in harmony or something, I often say my work, I no longer work as a journalist, but my work as a journalist was transformed by this practice. And you knew me before this practice as a journalist. Utterly transformed, but just from like the very basic thing of instead of making the practice of the work of a journalist being about me writing a good story, me being the best editor, me being high on the staff, me having everyone know where I work and what I do, it became about providing this service for the readers. Editing the texts in such a way so that it would be crystal clear as possible for the reader. Trying to give them the best information within the very tight constraints that I was given. Because journalism as a whole, we have a lot of constraints, just formal constraints of space, time, and then within each operation, you have what the owners want, what the boss wants, what the advertisers want. So within all of those constraints, I tried to really do the best I could to make the train come on time, to make the paper be on time, to be clear, to bring the best news as best I could to the readers. Sometimes I didn't have choice. Often I didn't think that those five stories were the stories that should be on page one. I could go in and argue for other stories, but ultimately it was someone else who would make the decision. So then I would try to do the best I could with the story that I was assigned to make it clear, concise. Didn't matter if my name was on it. Had absolutely no importance if my name appeared on that story. So, same job, different experience of it.
But in our society, so much functions just the opposite.
Yep, it does.
When I think of the scientific world, and if you don't if your name is not the first one on the paper or whatever, it just doesn't count, or, you know, and...
Yep, it's true. So then,
just on that.
Yeah, I mean, we do live in a culture where, you know, greed is basically institutionalized, and so is anger and ignorance. So what do we do then? And what choices do we? We are free to make the choices that